Your Honors, may it please the Court, and I would ask to reserve 4 minutes, please, for rebuttal. My name is Matthew Gunn of the Rossman Law Group in Boise, Idaho, and we represent Mr. Michael O'Connor.
I'm sorry, what's your name?
Matthew Gunn, Your Honor.
Oh, so Mr. Rossman's not here today?
Your Honor, it was my understanding that we submitted a notice that our firm did. I signed all the briefs in this case, and my understanding is that we submitted a notice that I would be arguing here today. Mr. Rossman was initially supposed to, but he was unable to attend due to personal reasons.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I apologize for any confusion with regards to that point. Your Honors, my firm represents Mr. Michael O'Connor in his age discrimination lawsuit against Cimer, LLC. And we're here today because the District Court for the District of Idaho erred in entering summary judgment in favor of Cimer with regards to Mr. O'Connor's age discrimination claim. As the District Court noted in its decision, the Court's role at summary judgment is not to weigh the evidence and determine the truth of the matter, but to determine whether or not there is a genuine issue for trial. The Court thus appropriately recognized what it was tasked to do at summary judgment and then promptly did not do that.
Well, this is a strange case for me. We hardly ever see McDonnell Douglas Stage 1 summary judgments. We see them typically after we've gone through the whole rigmarole of all three stages. But I'm trying to figure out in this case what evidence you had of age discrimination. The difference in the age from the person replacing your client wasn't sufficient to give rise to a presumption of discrimination. So we have to have some other circumstances that establish that. The judge, your client said, well, my boss made a lot of ageist comments, but when asked what they were, couldn't remember them. Let's assume that's all you had. Would that be enough?
Well, Your Honor, I think we're assuming a situation that doesn't exist.
Of course, that's what hypotheticals are.
Fair point.
So start with that one.
No, Your Honor. I believe that would be enough. The courts have held that explicitly ageist comments have been enough to overcome.
Right, but I agree that explicitly ageist comments are enough. But as I understand your client's testimony on this point, there's some other stuff that may be better for you. He said, my boss made lots of ageist remarks, but it's so long ago or my memory is faded, I can't remember precisely what they were. And the judge said, gee, if you can't remember any, I'm not going to use those to get to your burden. Is that a credibility determination or is that a failure of proof?
That's exactly what that is, Your Honor, is the judge weighing evidence, the judge impermissibly judging my client's credibility. He is saying that horrible comments were made with regards to his
age. But he can't identify any of them.
But that goes to his credibility to his weight. He is saying that the comments occurred. He's saying, I can't remember context, I can't remember specifics. But he's not saying that the comments didn't occur.
But the only thing he says is that they were ageist. Isn't that a legal conclusion rather than a factual description of the comments?
I don't believe he used the term ageist, Your Honor. He said, I get a lot of age-related comments. Some are great, some are horrible comments. Some are with age, some weren't with age. He described them as horrible comments. That's not a legal conclusion. He went on to say, he tells me I've been there too long, that basically because of my age,
and
he wants me out.
Those are specific comments, and they may well be enough to meet what's the very small burden that you have at step one. I was trying to focus on, you say the judge made a credibility determination when he said, if you can't remember any of the comments, I can't use them. I'm not sure that's a credibility determination as much as you got to come up with something specific.
But, Your Honor, I do want to nitpick slightly and parse out the difference between someone saying, I can't remember whether comments were made or not, versus someone saying, I can't remember the specifics of comments being made. Someone saying, I remember the comments being made, but I don't remember specifics of them, I submit, Your Honor, is a clear issue of credibility. And whether or not the judge or the jury, the fact finder, is going to assess that this is credible, that these memories are credible, but there is a distinct difference between someone saying, the comments occurred, but I can't remember the specifics of the comments, versus someone saying, I have no idea if the comments even occurred.
What's your best case, or do you have one that you can cite for us that really clearly shows that this meets the burden? I know this is less than a preponderance of the evidence. It's a very low bar at this stage Do you have a case that you can cite to that gives you your best case as to why this meets that burden?
It's the cases discussing that the analysis under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, Your Honor, is a totality of the circumstances analysis, because we focused here on the explicit comments. But we can't just
So the answer to my question is you don't have a case, or just
Your Honor, it would be the cases cited in our briefing. Where courts have repeatedly said that the totality of the circumstances must in each case create a reasonable inference that the employer's stated reasons were a pretext for unlawful age discrimination. That was a discussion from Connell versus Bank of Boston, which is a First Circuit case, going into a Northern District of California case, Offield versus Holder, in which the court engaged in totality of the circumstances analysis and saying, for now, however, it is sufficient to conclude that, taken as a whole and with all reasonable inferences resolved in plaintiff's favor, plaintiff's evidence is sufficient for a finder of fact to conclude that the 2009 actions were taken as pretext for age discrimination or retaliation.
So tell me what specific evidence you have in this case that would give rise to that inference. And put aside for a second the general statement that, well, my boss made a horrible statements over time, but I can't remember any of them. Tell me what specific evidence you have that meets your standard burden.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm happy to, but one thing as I go through that I want to make clear that this evidence is a totality of the circumstances.
I understand. You've said that seven times. I caught it the third. So yeah. Just tell me what the evidence you have.
Yes, Your Honor. The numerous explicit comments that we submit are explicit, and a key part of this case is...
Which numerous explicit comments are you citing?
Where he refers to telling it that there were numerous horrible comments.
Okay.
You know, you might be too old for this job, for a field service job.
Okay.
And I just feel when he tells me I've been there too long that basically because of my age, he wants me out. So we have three different...
Where in the record, because I was looking for it, where in the record is the statement you might be too old for this job, for a field service job?
That's on page 242 of the record, Your Honor. Page 307 of Mr. O'Connor's deposition testimony. At lines 16 to 19.
Thank you.
Your Honor, and then you have to couple that with the other evidence that from which age discrimination can be inferred. And we submit that one of the absolute keys in this case is the issue of salary, pay, and tenure. Hayes and Paper, the Supreme Court says that issues such as salary and tenure are in a vacuum are analytically distinct from age. But, Your Honor, there are numerous cases saying that there can be an issue of fact as to whether or not salary and tenure are used as a proxy for age. And I submit, Your Honor, there is a clear issue of fact in this case as to whether or not Symer used salary and tenure, undisputed hundreds of comments regarding that Mr. O'Connor has been there too long, makes too much money, as a proxy for age, because there is a key fact in the record, Your Honor, that is undisputed, admitted in the depositions by Symer, that Mr. O'Connor offered to take a 50% pay cut in order to stay with the company, and they said no. And so the fact that they said no, refused him a 50% pay cut, tells us, whoa, we got an issue of fact here, that this was really about pay. They would have let him take a pay cut. And, Your Honor, on page 12 of the record, the district court's decision, the district court, again, weighed the evidence, weighed credibility, and made an impermissible inference in favor of the moving party, Symer, when the district court noted that there could be any number of non-discriminatory reasons that Symer decided to not allow Mr. O'Connor to take a pay cut. But none of those reasons are in the record. That's theoretical musing that is drawing inferences that work against Mr. O'Connor, that is weighing the evidence, that's weighing the credibility of the witnesses. And that's simply not something the district court is permitted to do at this stage of proceedings.
And this is the reason that I said this was unusual. Normally we see these at stage three of the McDonnell-Douglas analysis. I assume they have facially non-pretextual reasons for terminating your client. They say he was doing a terrible job. And then we would get to whether or not you could could meet your burden of showing that those were pretextual. It sounds almost as if the judge jumped ahead to that stage. So let's assume we were there Would you have enough? And their reason was he was doing a terrible job. Is the evidence you have enough to create a question of fact on pretext?
Absolutely, Your Honor. This all stemmed, the termination of Mr. O'Connor stemmed from a PIP, a performance improvement plan, that Mr. O'Connor was placed on in August of 2014. Admittedly, the day before he was going on vacation, his supervisor told him to read the PIP and weep. And so he is placed on this PIP 3 months after he receives a performance review that tells him he is meeting expectations, and he is given a merit raise, a merit-based raise, and a merit-based increase in salary. As part of those merit-based increases and raise in pay and salary, he's commended for the job that he's doing. It is undisputed that in 18 years of employment with Slimer, he had zero issues, zero instances of progressive discipline. And so to the extent we jump ahead a little bit and consider whether or not there's a pretext, there is clearly an issue of fact as to whether or not they're using this PIP as a pretext here, given his...
Yeah, but they told him he had to abide by the PIP, and he said, I think in response, that he didn't believe he was bound by the PIP, because ultimately I think he was terminated for insubordination. And so did he receive some sort of confirmation that he was no longer bound by the PIP?
Your Honor, this is another issue of disputed fact. It's Mr. O'Connor's testimony that he was told by the human resources specialist that he was no longer bound by the bad examples of bad performance in the PIP. And there are factual issues with how we interpreted that and how we took it. But at an absolute minimum, Mr. O'Connor's testimony is clear that he never understood that it was comply with the PIP or be fired. His testimony on pages 60 and 68 of the record are that I understood that, you know, at most, maybe I'm going to get progressive discipline for the first time in my 18-year career, given my recent merit-based increases and increases in pay and increases in salary. Not all of a sudden, whoa, this is a one strike and you're out situation. So we clearly have a genuine issue of material fact regarding that PIP and the circumstances of the termination.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
The relationship between Mr. Robinson and Ms. Vinson?
Ms. Vinson.
Person? They were involved in the ultimate decision to terminate Mr. O'Connor, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And she allegedly told him that he could disregard the PIP?
That's his testimony, that he, and there is disputing conflicted testimony on this point, but it's his testimony that she agreed with him that when he presented documentary evidence that the basis for the PIP was factually false, that she told him, I'm throwing out all the basis for the PIP. And then there is admittedly disputed testimony as to what the implications of that were and what Mr. O'Connor understood the implications of that to be.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Before you do, I want to ask you, you identified page 242 of the record in the deposition transcript. When I'm looking at it, here's the question. So it's your testimony now that he said you were too old to do this job. He told me I'd been there too long. He told me at times you should find something else to do. And he told me that before. I don't know if it was that I was too old or something to do with age. So he didn't testify that his boss told him he was too old. He testified that he told him he'd been there too long. Correct?
We're on page
307. Well, you're going to come back up. Why don't you take a look at that, and maybe you can address it when you come back up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is David Barton. My partner, Christine Burns, and I represent Slimer, the defendant in this case. The District Court applied the appropriate standards in this case and found that in response to Slimer's well-supported motion for summary judgment, O'Connor had failed to present sufficient evidence to create an inference that his age was the but-for causes of his discharge. Under Rule 56, there was no genuine issue of material fact for trial, and the Court properly entered summary judgment.
Standard here is pretty low, isn't it?
The standard here is Rule 56.
Well, no, the standard may be Rule 56, but the level of evidence of ageist, if you will, motivation, we've repeatedly said, doesn't even have to rise to a preponderance of the evidence. You just have to have some admissible evidence of age motivation. Isn't that correct?
Let me address both of those points. The very low language that has been mentioned many times by the plaintiff and is trying to urge this court to rely upon comes from Lowe versus City of Monrovia. The Lowe opinion was amended by this court because the court was concerned that it might be construed to impede a summary judgment. So after Lowe was issued, the Ninth Circuit issued an amended opinion which said the following: the principles described above do not prevent the summary disposition of meritless suits, but simply ensure that when a genuine issue of material fact exists, a civil rights litigant will not be denied a trial on the merits.
But we've said it again. We said it in Wallace and Simplot, too. Any number of times we've said, remember, we have this, we're only talking about part four of the age of discrimination test. He's old enough. He contests that he was fired for legitimate reasons. So the question is, and we can't use the replacement, so we're looking to see whether there's any evidence in the record that might lead a reasonable finder of fact to find age discrimination. And he says, put aside the general statements, my boss told me all the lots of times you've been here too long. He made remarks about how the younger people were cheaper and smarter. Not much. I must say it's not the strongest evidence I've ever seen, but doesn't it get to that low bar that we talk about?
Well, again, looking at Lowe as well, I think it's important we focus on that because that's where the very, very little language comes from. And the preface to using that language, when you read the Lowe case, the court said, when a plaintiff does not rely exclusively on the presentation, on the presumption, the McDonnell-Douglas presumption, but seeks to establish a prima facie case through the submission of actual evidence, very little of such evidence is required. So reading Lowe in it, the actual language from Lowe, we find that what the court is saying is when the plaintiff has got actual evidence, substantial evidence, significant evidence, evidence that gets him past or could get him past summary judgment, then very little of that kind of evidence is required in order to pass the test. So we shouldn't misconstrue Lowe.
Okay, so we're talking about, now I'm not sure, we're talking about very little of admissible evidence. And so why isn't it admissible evidence that his boss said to him, you've been here too long, you're costing me a lot of money, and these new young guys are cheaper and smarter?
Okay, good questions. That's Hayes and Paper, of course. The Hayes and Paper Supreme Court decision made it clear that decisions that can be analytically distinct from age do not create an inference of age discrimination unless the context suggests that somehow the employer was trying to get rid of, for example, more expensive workers. And that's the point of this case here. There's absolutely no evidence that Symer was trying to eliminate more expensive workers, or older workers for that matter. In fact, the individual who replaced Mr. O'Connor was exactly his age, just 3 weeks younger. That individual still works for Symer today.
I thought he was 8 years younger.
There were two individuals. So the individual who first replaced Mr. O'Connor was 3 weeks younger than him. The second individual, 4 months later, that was replaced was 8 weeks younger. That's correct. Or 8 years younger.
Neither of them get to the presumption.
That is correct. Neither of them get a presumption.
I couldn't find this in the case law, and I suspect both of you are more expert on this than I. This presumption is not a sliding scale, is it? In other words, is it a bright line? If you're 10 years or more, there's a presumption. If they're 10 years or less, there's not. What if you were 9 years, 11 months, would there be something of a presumption?
The case that established the 10-year presumption was, I believe, the Frost case, if I can find it here. But it was out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it said it is a presumption. It's a rebuttable presumption.
Is it a bright line?
It is.
In other words, if you fall on one side of it, there's no presumption. The other side, there is.
Yes, 10 years is a bright line. Yeah, it's rebuttable, but it's a bright line. But it's not contested in this case. They were not substantially younger. He was only 8 years younger.
Yes. I thought Mr. Robinson told the appellant that because of the appellant's age, Mr. O'Connor's age, he wanted appellant out. And there was also another reference, I thought, in the record, and it may be the one that was being discussed earlier, where Mr. Robinson told Mr. O'Connor that he needed to find something else to do because apparently how the appellant interpreted it was because he might be too old for his job, for a field service job. And then it appears, I think, in June of 2014, or around that time, I'm not sure on the timing, the appellant reported that Mr. Robinson had referred to younger employees as supermen and had also made disparaging remarks about appellant's income. And then appellant reported that he felt like he was discriminated against for age. You don't think all of that meets the very low bar that we have established here, especially when we have to look at this in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, given the reasonable inferences to the plaintiff?
I don't, Your Honor, for these reasons. First of all, you have just simply three comments, okay? It's not as if we have comments with something else that would suggest an inference of age discrimination.
Well, and you have him saying, he said so many comments over the 2.5 years that were, you know, age discriminatory comments. And I know he doesn't identify him, but then that's just dismissed out of hand?
It's not dismissed out of hand, but it's the kind of conclusory statement that this court has repeatedly said will not beat a summary judgment motion. You can't just simply say they were 100. Well, what the exact quote is.
Are we at summary judgment? I mean, we're trying to determine whether or not a prima facie case was established, correct?
Correct.
On that fourth prong.
Correct.
Okay. Go ahead. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. Okay.
The comment, there were hundreds of comments, some good, some bad, some about age, some not, is exactly the kind of conclusory statement that this court has said it cannot be used to create inference of discrimination because it's immeasurable. How do you know what those comments were? Some of them were good, some of them were not good, some of them about age, some of them not. So it is impossible to give that any weight because it's simply a conclusion.
Well, and that's why I was asking your friend about specific statements, and he may not have identified his best one, but there sure are a lot of statements that along the lines of, you've been here too long, you're making too much money, the younger people are smarter and make less money. You may well be able at a later stage of summary judgment to demonstrate that none of these were a pretext for discrimination, but don't they get them past stage one?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because again, the second point I was going to raise about these comments is that they are badly misconstrued. As the court pointed out in reading the deposition testimony.
Well, that's why I think he can't rely on that one, but there's some other unequivocal times when he says, my boss told me I'd been here too long. My boss told me I was making too much money. My boss told me the younger people were smart and cost less.
Well, isn't that
enough to give rise to at least an inference of discrimination?
It's not. Let's take the comment you're making too much money for starters. If I were to talk about a Google employee who is fresh out of college, 20 years old, and is making $100,000 a year, you might say he's making too much money. And that's why Hayes and Paper says that when a comment is not directly related to age or doesn't have some direct age-related problem, it can't be evidence to create an inference of age discrimination.
But what about the you've been here too long? You've been here too long suggests that one of the reasons you're making so much money is you've gotten older.
Examine the context of the you've been here too long comment. I don't believe was ever actually attributed to Mr. Robertson. He was told that you've been with the company too long to be sitting in Boise doing nothing. And that was the idea, is that he was in Boise, and that's at ER 75 in Mr. Robertson's notes, as confirmed in ER 145, where he reported it to HR. He was concerned that he wasn't being effective in his job, that he'd been here long enough that he needed to find something to do because he wasn't doing enough to justify his salary.
You seem to be taking all these comments in isolation. When you take them cumulatively, they give another impression.
Well, the district court took them cumulatively. The district court looked at all of the comments in context and said, in context, they don't rise to the level to create an inference of discrimination. They don't meet that fourth prong of the McDonnell-Douglas test.
We review that conclusion de novo.
We do review that de novo, for sure. So this court should look at all the evidence. And I would suggest that when the court looks at all of the evidence and compares the cases that are similar to this case, where there have been these kinds of comments that have been made, this case just simply doesn't measure up. So, for example, in the Nesbitt case, the court said, you know, we don't necessarily like all the gray hair around here. This court said that wasn't enough. In the Pottinger case, there was evidence that the employer had said, we were tired of the old management team, and it referred to the older workers as deadwood. This court again said that wasn't enough. Or perhaps in the one of my favorite cases, actually, is Howard versus Ryder Trucks. And that's a good example of what we're talking about here. It's not enough to throw out a couple of comments and suggest that that's going to get you past summary judgment. In Howard versus Ryder Trucks, the district court entered summary judgment when the plaintiff had produced two comments, that one of the plaintiffs had been referred to as an old goat, and the other employee had been told, you're so old, you should start exercising. So those were comments, cases that the court looked at comparatively. But in addition, Howard produced, there were three plaintiffs, all of whom were older, one of them had been with the company for 36 years, had all been there more than 20 years. They were fired for a policy that had not been consistently enforced, and there was evidence that the company had been trying to save money. Its profits were down, and so the company had been trying to save money by reducing expenses, by letting older workers go and hiring younger ones who cost less. All of that evidence was presented to the district court. The district court still granted summary judgment, and this court affirmed.
Was that a summary judgment at stage one of the McDonnell-Douglas analysis?
The court has raised this point a couple of times, which is a good one. The McDonnell-Douglas case has two phases. The initial phase of
you have to have a prima facie case.
You have to have a prima facie case.
Or we don't go any further.
That's correct.
Then if we do, it's your burden to come back and show you had a non-pretextual reason, and then they can come back and show it was a pretext.
So was Howard at phase one?
Howard is a phase two case, actually.
Yeah, and that's why I'm having some difficulty with these things. So in Howard, they came back with non-pretextual reasons, and the other side never could rebut it. In Howard, on all that evidence, it survived stage one, didn't it?
It survived stage one because the plaintiffs were replaced by younger employees. We don't have that fact here. And in fact, that suggests that as the court properly ruled, that the plaintiffs hadn't mustered sufficient evidence to overcome the presumption.
So and just assuming my framework is right, which it may not be, do you have a phase one case where you think the evidence was greater than this and we nonetheless sustained summary judgment?
I do, actually, if you give me just a second.
You can always provide a supplemental site if it's not at hand.
We'll do that. I can look it up really quickly, though. I've got it here. I would suggest the court to Scheitlin versus Freescale Semiconductor.
I'm sorry, say the first.
Scheitlin, Scheitlin versus Freescale Semiconductor. I believe it's a phase one case. And also,
won't you give us a site for that while you've got it at hand?
465 Fed Appendix 698. And Pottinger versus Potlatch, 329 F3rd 740. I believe both of those were first phase cases, the prima facie case cases.
What were the facts in those?
Pottinger was a former employee, brought a case under the ADA and the Idaho Human Rights Act, very much like this. Employee, I don't have the facts exactly right just yet, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll just make a couple of points here very briefly. I think Your Honors were understanding the argument we're trying to make here, Your Honor, that it's not just the direct comments. It's not just the salary, pay, and tenure. It's not just the young techs being supermen. It's not just the circumstances of the PIP. It's all of that together looked at in the totality of those circumstances. These cases, the cases assessing the summary judgment burdens consistently say that there isn't a smoking gun in these cases. That's why we zealously safeguard an employment discrimination plaintiff's ability to go to trial, where we have the chance to weigh the credibility.
But we're not talking about going to trial here. We're talking about getting to the next stage of a summary judgment analysis, aren't we?
Correct, Your Honor, but the court made that statement in assessing whether or not summary judgment was appropriate, saying that these cases are ripe for trial when there's very little and minimal evidence because they're appropriate for finders of fact to consider, to weigh credibility, and to weigh all of the totality of the circumstances, because employers aren't dumb. Smoking gun evidence never exists in these cases. We've been doing this for a long time, and there is never smoking gun evidence. One other point I want to make briefly, Symer is critical of Mr. O'Connor in his briefing in here today for these conclusory or self-serving allegations. Your Honors, in SEC versus Fan and Nigro versus Sears Roebuck, the Ninth Circuit has repeatedly said that the district court may not disregard a piece of evidence at the summary judgment stage solely based on its self-serving nature. An affidavit that is self-serving bears on its credibility, which the court can't weigh at the summary judgment stage, not on the cognizability for purposes of establishing a genuine issue of material fact. It must be taken as true at the summary judgment stage what Mr. O'Connor testified, that there were hundreds of horrible comments. Essentially, there were so many horrible comments that that's why I can't remember the specifics. Not that there were so few, there were so many. Those have to be taken as true at the summary judgment stage.
Thank you very much. Appreciate both your arguments here today, Mr. Gunn, Mr. Barton. Thank you very much. The case of Michael O'Connor versus Symer, LLC is now submitted.